When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Green light 3-0 and she's gone!
Welcome to the 3-0 Show, part of the Athletic Baseball Show. It is Thursday, April 14th. As you listen to this episode, we are speaking mid-morning on the East Coast. No, late morning on the East Coast, even after lunchtime on the East Coast on Wednesday the 13th. It's been a great first week on the field overall. Lots of new things, as we've seen, with some new broadcast partners for the league, new booths working together. We saw history in San Francisco on Tuesday night. We'll talk about what happened and how we got there, which is also a huge story in and of itself that is still developing at the time of this recording. So we'll get to that, and we'll get to some contract extensions as well. The Guardians opening up the checkbook and keeping Jose Ramirez in Cleveland for what looks like the next 6 years altogether. So that's pretty exciting stuff if you are a fan of the Guardians. Ke'Bryan Hayes gets an extension with the Pirates, and an interesting twist, Reds president Phil Castellini threatened to move the team on the day of the Reds home opener. So, well played, sir. We'll dig into that story just a little bit later. But
oldest trick in the owner's book.
Great maneuver, great timing, just flawless. But let's start in San Francisco. The way the story came out, Alyssa Nacken made baseball history on Tuesday night, becoming the first woman to be an on-field coach in a major league game. And that is a great story. I'm kind of blown away, though, because as we dug into what happened, Antoine Richardson, the Giants' first base coach, was ejected from the game. The Giants were winning big, and I had just got back online. I went offline for a couple hours, came back, and I'm like, well, that's weird. A first base coach got tossed in a game that the Giants are winning big. What the heck's going on there? Well, this is cool. Alyssa Nacken's on the field. That's great. She's been a part of the organization for 3 seasons now. Getting this opportunity, it's a great step forward, right? It's the long overdue progress of a female coach on the field. But what is going on with this whole story? Like, this is one of the more unusual things. You were at the ballpark on Tuesday night, and it sounds like it was just as confusing if you were there as if you were trying to parse out what was happening from afar.
Yeah, it was really strange. I mean, it's hard also when you're at the ballpark to see into both dugouts and to just have the same view. Like, I think in some cases, maybe this case, the viewer at home had a better sense of what was happening, because you saw that the players in the Padres dugout were chirping when it had to do with, in the second inning, a stolen base with, I think, Steven Duggar stole a base, with the scores like 10-1 or something in the second inning. And it was already weird because the catcher didn't throw to second. And then there was like this weird pause in the game. And I remember talking to the person next to me about, you know, defensive indifference. And I was like, could they do a defensive indifference there? Like the catcher didn't even pretend to throw. But we looked it up, and it's almost always awarded only in the ninth inning. With the runner that doesn't matter, you know, like the lead runner that doesn't matter in like a 3-run game or something. So I knew there was something going on, but I couldn't tell that it was the dugouts chirping at each other. And then when Nacken came out, I was like, what happened to Richardson? Like, what is going on? And apparently what had happened was that there was a bunt single from Mauricio Dubon in the third, I think, where the score was like 12-2 or something. And they were mad about that. And so there was some chirping directly at Richardson, who at this point is off the field. Richardson has left the field, and he hadn't been yelling at anybody. From what we could see, he'd just gone off the field and he was in the dugout. And You know, Bob Melvin after the bunt did make it sort of a gesture towards Gabe Kapler in the other end, like sort of like a hands up in the air, like what's going on, dude? You know, like really. And so I guess Mike Schilt, who is what do you know what coach? What
he's his the role third is? Base coach for San
third
Diego.
Base coach for the Padres, former manager of the Cardinals. He yells over to the other dugout. About you have to control that guy, or you know
that MF-er. Mother effer was the actual direct MF-er. Quote,
and
referring to Richardson.
Referring to Richardson, I guess I think to this date, like we don't have like clarity about some of these things. Like he guess he could have been talking about Dubon. I don't know if that makes it any better or worse, but like you know, and Richardson steps to the top step to be like, "Are you talking about me?" Like. Are you talking to me? And he gets thrown out of the game for stepping to the top step like that. That to me is almost the most problematic part because this other stuff is just really about unwritten rules, about not stealing, not running up the score. You know, I have a little rant about that, but you know, that I think we sort of have some agreement that the weirdest and the part that's not really being covered by this is the fact that Richardson got thrown out for not doing very much.
Right. And Wednesday morning, just before we started recording, Mike Schilt and Anton Richardson met on the field. There was about a 90-second clip from the NBC Sports Bay Area. No audio, so no idea what was exchanged.
One last missing piece is that Richardson alluded to sort of racial undertones. He did not, you know, point at anyone and say, that was racist or you were racist. It was sort of like, you know, when someone says you got to control that MF-er, you know, to a black person, you know, that has a lot of loaded language.
Absolutely.
That's what Richardson like sort of talked to reporters after the game about that.
Yeah. So they met Wednesday. We don't know what was exchanged at this time. There were a couple of handshakes and hugs and they parted ways. So I don't know what comes next in this story, but I think the real unanswered question was if the last thing Anton Richardson said on the field before he got ejected by Greg Gibson, the crew chief at Tuesday's game, if the last thing he said was excuse me to what Mike Schilt said to him, mm-hmm. I have no idea how Anton Richardson gets ejected from this game. It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. It was something Richardson addressed in his post-game comments as well, because if he gets ejected in that exchange and Schilt was directing what he said at Anton Richardson, it's completely backwards. So, again, further explanation is needed. Umpires are mic'd up. You're ejecting someone from a game. Tell us why.
Tell us why.
And you missed it on the field, so you better tell us now. Reveal more details here. Explain. Give us any possible missing info there could be. You better hand it over now, because as it played out, otherwise, as it's been reported so far, this was a really ugly incident on the field in San Francisco.
Right, because otherwise we have to fill in the gaps, and then we have to talk about, you know, what the undertones of this were and what the meaning was. If you had sort of been more transparent and told us, you know, and then as it pertains to the sort of unwritten rules, there was some other interesting things going on where like Gabe Kapler and Alex Cobb and a lot of the players, like Jock Peterson was like, don't like it, play better. Alex Cobb was like, hey, we've talked about this. We want to win every series as much as we can. We want to get as deep into every bullpen as we can. This is about not only winning this game, you know, by as many runs as we can, but by making it more likely we win the next game by tiring pitchers out. Like, we just want to score and we want pedal to the metal for every out that we've got. Don't make outs, make it, you know, score as many runs as you can. And I think that there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And I agree a little bit with what Jock Peterson says when he says, you know, don't like it, play better. But also, there's a couple other things I want to point out. One is, this is a business where players are rewarded on an individual level. So if you are Mauricio Dubon and you're about to go into arbitration, it does matter if you get the hit or not. And that is separate from, you know, any discussion of team situation, right? It does matter what you do as a player. You get rewarded for that individually. So you have to keep playing. And then secondly, the other team is still playing. The other team is still shifting. The other team is still trying to strike you out. I mean, yeah, maybe don't steal a base against a position player pitching. I don't know. Even then, why not? It could help you in arbitration. It could be an extra $100,000. It could be an extra $50,000 in arbitration. So I don't know, man. I think that while you're out there, if you've got an out left on the board, you should play as hard as possible. And I think that's actually kind of an old school thing to say, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't it old school to say, if the game is still on, try?
I've never liked these unwritten rules that have plagued the game, that take the fun out of the game. You're talking about things that were happening in the second and third inning. Teams come back. Teams, if you can take a 10-run lead in the first three innings of a game, guess what? Someone can erase a 10-run lead in the next three innings, next one inning of a game. So why should you be expected to change the way you're going to play? Why? That makes absolutely no sense to me whatsoever.
And how many times have you seen it in other sports where, you know, they do go into like a prevent defense on football, right? Where they're like, you know, like, we're just going to try and keep the long plays down. And the other team comes back with little dinks and dunks and runs down the field, right? Or in basketball where they're like, okay, we're just going to slow it down. And then all of a sudden the other team, you know, gets back into it. I think you should, if there was a way of winning that got you winning, then you should continue to do that. Because if you stop doing that, you may lose.
Mm-hmm. Well, there were some other things that happened over the past week. It wasn't all just what we saw in San Francisco on Tuesday night. And there were some new booths that actually came together because, as we talked about on this show a few weeks ago, Apple TV actually has Friday Night Baseball. And I was able to catch most of the two games that they picked up. They had two new groups working together. Melanie Newman was on play-by-play for the earlier of the two games. Chris Young and Hannah Kaiser were the two analysts in that group. And in the later game, which was an Angels-Astros matchup, had Steven Nelson, Hunter Pence, and Katie Nolan working together. I didn't even realize that that was a combination. I knew Melanie Newman was a part of the play-by-play plan for Apple when that story first came out. And looking at the two booths and listening to those, like, the first booth was excellent. The first booth, you could not tell that those three people hadn't called games together before, which is remarkable. As someone who speaks into a microphone for most of my job, having chemistry with people you haven't worked with before, it varies quite a bit. I could speak to this. And they did a fantastic job on that early game. There was plenty of drama in that game, too. That was probably the biggest on-field drama of the week, where the Nationals constantly hitting Mets batters. I mean, they hit Francisco Lindor in the head with a pitch. Pete Alonso got hit. Buck Showalter was losing his mind, understandably so, because the Nats, without command, just kept drilling guys. And anyway, I thought that booth was really good. And the second game, I felt like you could tell a little bit more that was the first time out for that group. But I like that we're putting new combinations of people together in these booths, right? If you're going to have games scattered on all these different rights holders, that opens up the door for new people to call games, for new voices to be in the booth. And I found that to be very refreshing. Even in Sunday night's case, when on ESPN, the main broadcast, they obviously had the Michael K. A-Rod, K-Rod cast together on ESPN2, but the main ESPN booth, Carl Ravitch, Eduardo Perez, David Cohn, I thought that was a great combination as well.
Oh, that was really great. The other one was not.
I didn't flip over to it because I was just enjoying the main feed, and I
I used the like voice control to get the game on, and I was like, why am I watching the most boring A-Rod stuff? Oh, it's so bad. It was so bad. And then somebody was on Twitter going, man, this booth is really great. And I was like, they cannot be talking about this A-Rod thing I'm watching. And I realized I was watching like the Alterna cast. And yes, the Cohn booth was really good.
So I enjoyed that, among other things, over the first week.
The Apple broadcast, I thought, was also interesting because they did try to bring a couple different sort of wrinkles to it. Visually, mm-hmm. I thought that the score bug was a little bit different looking, and then they also had, and I'm not, I'm not sure 100% about, like, you know, how good these percentages were, but they had, like, you know, hit percentages and on-base percentages that changed with the count, and gave you a sense of what I liked about it was the count is really important in baseball, you know, like the just in terms of your likelihood of getting on base, likelihood of getting a hit, but also what the hitter is doing. I mean, you could do fun things like likelihood of a swing in this count, because the swing rates change very largely from when it comes to what count you're in, right? And you could do things with the pitcher mix, with how different some pitchers have very different pitcher mix based on count. So there was and it was like in an inobtrusive way, I thought, right? Like it was like if you didn't know you were looking for it, you wouldn't necessarily see it. It wasn't like, you know, big and blazing thing. It was kind of like a fun thing they could talk about if they wanted to. And it didn't become like a huge character that made everybody on Twitter mad about hit probabilities.
Right. It was subtly done. And yeah. I was finding myself questioning the math, even though I didn't have...
Right. Some of the numbers were a little bit high.
Yeah. I had my own machine, my own program running to give me some insight into the situation. I was like, is that really right? Like, not in a negative sort of way. I don't think about those probabilities in those moments. Like, I would think about them in the off season if I were reading about various baseball situations, but I'm never thinking about them on a granular level like that. And I just thought that was an interesting presentation wrinkle. And I'm sure we'll see new things along the way. But I thought the video quality was also really good, too. I saw some people commenting on Twitter that it might have been like a true 4K broadcast or something. So really nice to see that presentation. I thought that was very well done across the board.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Guys tend to think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort, but it's possible to have it both ways. I'm all set for summer thanks to Mack Weldon. The Vesper polo shirt is so breathable you can wear it on the golf course, but it looks classy enough to wear to a party. The Maverick Tech chino short is ultra flexible, and the Pima crew neck t-shirt is perfect for those casual weekends. There's no need to be uncomfortable in your clothing ever again. Some guys just want to look good without calling attention to themselves. Mack Weldon apparel gives you understated good looks for understated confidence. Mack Weldon clothes are designed to fit your style and the demands of modern life. They look like regular clothes but feel like the latest in modern comfort. They're the go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. Breathable underwear that keeps you cool, dry, and comfy all day. Crazy comfortable but elevated sweatpants. An upgraded classic polo with antimicrobial silver threads. An ultra-soft antimicrobial tee for when you need to stay fresh longer. That's the Silver Crew Neck T-shirt. Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code MLBSHOW. That's MackWeldon.com. Promo code MLB Show.
But a lot of things happened in the last week. We're going to try and get to as many of them as we can. How about Jose Ramirez getting a five-year extension with the Guardians? I think you and I and Britt tried on multiple occasions to trade Jose Ramirez to Toronto, among other places. And this is the better outcome. We'd like players to get paid and stay with their original franchise if they want to stay there, and he can be that franchise player now, right? We were upset when Francisco Lindor got traded to New York, but keeping Ramirez around, it's a player to build around for them, and they've got a lot of great young talent in that farm system right now. I think the question still comes back to, with the Guardians, how much are they really going to spend on payroll around Jose Ramirez? Because even a team running a $50-ish million payroll on opening day can squeeze in one $20 million player if most of the roster is made up with pre-arbitration players.
Yeah, I think that's partially it. You want to guess right and extend the right guy. That's something that even the A's have tried to do. They tried to extend Matt Chapman. They did extend Eric Chavez. You know, there's different different guys. They've missed on some. They did extend Chris Davis. That didn't work out so well. But, you know, I do think that's part of it, is just, you know, find a core piece and extend them. And then the rest are going to be kind of moving around them. Then there's also the fact that they almost did trade him, apparently. That's what the scuttlebutt is that that was came down to trade him or extend him. So I don't, I hope that there wasn't any sort of using the trade rumors as leverage to get this thing signed. But there obviously was some sort of connection between, you know, we would rather have cost certainty and know you're going to be here, or we would trade you, right? That's the thinking, I think, in the Guardians front office. And then the last bit that I find pretty interesting is that there was a change in the last collective bargaining agreement that I did not really spot, but Dan Szymborski, it almost sounded like I said damn.
It did.
Dan Szymborski. I did not. That damn Szymborski.
That Zip system really makes me mad.
Who, yeah, the father of Zip's projections over at Fangraphs had a cool tweet. He said, it may be use it or lose it for revenue sharing. Previously, the CBA put the burden on teams to prove they spent revenue sharing money on winning if payroll was less than 125% of revenue sharing money. Now it's 150%. So in other words, for example, in 2019, the Marlins received $70 million in revenue sharing from the collective bargaining agreement, from the collective bargaining, like the collective balance tax, right? So they got $70 million that year. If they spent $95 million on their payroll, then they were in the clear, basically, because, you know, they've done that. Now they would have to spend, why am I not doing the math? Oh, now they'd have to spend like $125 million, right? Basically. For the same threshold. So that's significant. And it's interesting because teams get right now about $61 million in national TV revenue. So those theoretical Marlins could still take the revenue money, take the national TV money, have $125 million payroll, and put $5 million in their pockets before a single person attended their games. So it's still not amazing. It's still like, you know, but I think these extensions, and we're going to have another one we're going to talk about, are a little bit of a nod towards like, oh, like, you know, crap, I better spend at least 150% of the revenue sharing money on payroll.
Right.
Or else they'll take me to court, which is what has happened in the past. The players union has had grievances against particular teams like the Pirates and the Marlins for not spending enough of the revenue money on winning.
I think it's interesting too, because anytime you get a player like this, you extend approaching age 30. Jose Ramirez turns 30 in September. He still had 1 year left on the previous 7-year deal that he signed, so he was under contract through 2023. This covers all of the years on the wrong side of 30. So I'm curious, as you look at a player like this and you think about a team like Cleveland, which is going to play on the smaller end of the scale payroll wise, when they invest in a player long term, they need that player to be someone that does not crater performance wise over the life of the deal, right? I think it does a lot more damage to a team like Cleveland to have an Albert Pujols-like contract. What happened with him in Anaheim is much more problematic if you're Cleveland operating under these tighter self-imposed constraints. When I look at Jose Ramirez, I see a player with skills that should age very well, right? We talk about him all the time on Rates and Barrels from a fantasy perspective. He's been a first-round fantasy pick for years because he's got power and he's got speed, but he's got good strike zone judgment. He does not strike out a lot. Plays on the infield. This is a guy that I think is still going to be a good
value. Yeah,
he's going to be a good big league player for most, if not all, of that deal. This is one of the safer skill sets that you can invest in long term if you're handing out long term deals.
I think so. And the other kind of deal that I think is really like this is the other extension that we saw, Ke'Bryan Hayes. 8 years and was it 70 million?
8 for 70. Yep.
This is I think the type of deal that every front office of a smaller market team is trying to do. And And so, therefore, I do think it's a little actually team friendly, because I think if Ke'Bryan Hayes hits his potential, you know, which is described by certain stats, like, for example, he hit a ball harder last year than Chris Bryant or Justin Turner ever did when he hit the ball 111 miles an hour. So he has good raw power. He just hasn't tapped into it. If he taps into that raw power, he will have made, he would have made more than $70 million. But this gives him some certainty. It gives him $70 million that he knows he's going to get. It's guaranteed. It's baseball. It's a guaranteed contract. And it gives the team cost certainty in terms of they know this is how much they have to give him going forward. And it sort of comes to... it's like the marriage of the risk and the risk aversion for both sides. Right? They've come to this number. If you doubt that every team would want to do this, like, you know, the Astros were handing them out and they didn't all work out. John Singleton?
Yeah, he was one of the few players, I think, that signed a contract like this. And this his deal was even smaller than the Hayes deal, but it was one at the time where I think all the writing about it was very, very team friendly, and it was a rare situation where it didn't work out.
Yes, there is risk for the team. There is risk for the team.
Usually does, though, because I think...
Those are the two examples I can think of. That's about it.
Every team in the league has a few players that are in the same sort of service time window as Ke'Bryan Hayes. They would offer an opportunity like this to buy out years of free agency, tack on some team options, and end up with a player whose average annual salary is under $10 million. Every team's got a few guys like this they'd offer that deal to. Many of those players would turn that deal down. I mean, look, the Pirates, they're one of those teams that they need to start gaining some positive momentum. Clearly, frustration with ownership there is off the charts high. And I think they do have some more young talent coming soon. So to have Hayes, who is going to be there for most of the same time anyway, this does take a couple years of free agency off the table for him, to make that commitment to him now, it's one small step in the direction of making this team very competitive again at some point in the not so distant future, right? The present is not bright. 2022 is not necessarily bright, but 2023, 2024, those could be much better years for the Pirates based on what they've got in that system right now.
And there's going to be some listeners who scoff at this idea, but combining the last conversation we had about the change in the CBA and current payrolls and this Hayes thing and the Pirates, it is possible that the Pirates will sort of have to spend more money soon. Now, the one loophole that I want to bring up about the CBA thing is because of 2020, because of the pandemic year, the CBA, the collective balance tax, there's been some weird things that have happened. So they had some sort of loan situation where the 2021 revenue sharing was not paid out in full last year because teams were hurting from 2020. So it said that 50% of the 2021 payments would come back this year. So they're in a weird gray zone when it comes to collective balance. I would say next year, the Players Union will sue the Pirates if they don't have at least $100 million payroll for luxury tax purposes, based on this 150% rule that's in the CBA. Right now, the Pirates have a luxury tax payroll of $72 million. So, you know, yes, maybe Ke'Bryan Hayes has a little bit more money next year, but there's still about $25-30 million that the Pirates may spend next year. I see that face. We're on YouTube. I can see that face.
I'm not making a face, am I?
Yes, you are. You, like many of the Pirates fans, do not believe that this will happen. But I am fascinated to see if they don't spend the money, if or how quickly the Players Union will take them to court.
I'm gonna give Pirates fans a hug. And you know,
all I'm gonna say.
I'm gonna say I'm on your side. And if you're the kind of person that says, I think Bob Nutting would rather go to court and spend a lot of money on legal fees than spend the money on payroll. If it saves him $5 million, he'll spend all the money he needs to save the $5 million. That's the kind of owner he's revealed himself to be to this point. But I'd be excited about a Cabrian Hayes extension. And I think if they are going to follow this model, if they want to do something similar with O'Neill Cruz soon after he becomes a regular big leaguer for them, if they want to do something similar with Henry Davis, if they want to take a core and actually try and offer up some deals quickly to those players to try and have a group of three or four guys that they have even beyond 6 years of big league control, that would be exciting for the Pirates. That would be a better version of what they have done in the past. So if you're optimistic in Pittsburgh, I'm sure it's a very cautious optimism, and you're not wrong for having cautious optimism, but you can be excited about this. You and I have talked about Cabrian Hayes many times. It comes back to hitting the ball in the air more consistently. He hits the ball hard. He needs to hit the ball in the air more often. Can they get that out of him? That's the big question. If they can do that, 20-plus home runs are well within reach. Good average, good OBP, great defense at third base. That is an excellent player to have as part of your core.
I think O'Neill Cruz is going to start tapping. I mean, he doesn't have to tap into the power. He's shown the power in games and the raw. And I think, you know, people make a big deal out of the fact that O'Neill Cruz is like 6'7" and can he play shortstop? But next to Cabrian Hayes, who will shortly be one of the top two or three defenders at third base in baseball, I think that you can have a tall shortstop, at least when he's young, you know. We've seen that with Carlos Correa, Corey Seager. There's been some taller shortstops recently where people said, oh, they're going to move to third, they're going to move to third. Well, there's fewer balls in play in today's game. And with shifting, you can put them into the right place. And then maybe with something like a guy next to him like Cabrian Hayes, you can do that. So then all of a sudden you're like, whoa, Hayes, Cruz, Reynolds. Hey, come on now. That's three good players.
That's three. How many do you need? You've done the research before. How many good players do you need?
It was three.
It's only three?
Three was a core, dude.
Why do I remember six as the number? Why didn't I trust you?
Three is enough of a core. I mean, four was better, but three was a core. Think about like how many good young players did the Cubs have when they went for it? What was their core?
Well, it was Bryant, Rizzo, Schwarber, Contreras, and they had great pitching at the time. At least some, like peak.
But none of those guys were young,
right?
I guess Hendricks, but you know, Arrieta was like a sort of a guy they got off of waivers or something. So I don't know. I think three or four was what the research said. And so if they've got three, you know, they're just looking for one more. And there could be signings. There could be a guy who pops up. Diego Castillo looks fun. Rodolfo Castro hits the ball really hard. They've got, you know, a few second basemen that could figure it out. First base is where you sign an older dude. And corner outfield is where you sign older dudes. So they're going to be good up the middle and young. So, I kind of hope for that, you know, that extra 20 to 30 million of spending that could, you know, kind of bring them to, you know, good status. I don't know about great.
Let's move on to the Reds, where I think the Castellini family might need to spend a little more money on PR, or maybe just not have Phil Castellini do interviews on the day of the home opener, or maybe never at all. But the interview that took place was on 700 WLW. See, Trent Rosecrans has a story about this. And Phil Castellini, he's the Reds president, son of Bob Castellini, was talking to Scott Sloan and Mo Egger. And they were asking him about, you know, payroll and this offseason, and it boiled down to a couple of quotes. Well, where are you going to go? Directed at Reds fans. Like, where else are you going to go to watch a major league game? Okay, that's pretty bad start. And then he continues with, sell the team to who? That's the other thing. You want to have this debate? If you want to look at what you would do with this team to have it be more profitable, make more money, compete in the current economic system that this game exists in, it would be to pick it up and move it somewhere else. He said that on the day of the home opener, which in Cincinnati, like opening day in every major league environment is a party to some degree. It always is. Cincinnati does have a different feel to it from everything I've ever seen. They usually get the first game of the season when they open at home too, because of when they start that game and being in Eastern time zone, they have a huge parade, schools stop for the day. I mean, it's a big deal. So it was maybe the worst day that you could say those words if you are a part of the Reds front office and ownership. So he apologized at the end of the day for what he said, which is whatever, you know, at this point. He said the quiet part out loud. I don't even think that should be the quiet part, though. So I wonder, are the Reds among the teams that perhaps could be changing hands? I wonder if the rules you were outlining and having to spend more on payroll will actually force some action for some of the ownership groups that have been reluctant to spend money on payroll. If they'll say, well, this is still profitable, but it's less profitable than I'd like it to be. And we're actually going to see a handful of teams become available as a result of those changes.
Yeah. I mean, we've heard a little bit already with the Learners in Washington, which doesn't strike me as a small market.
No.
But it is a complicated one because they're still, I think, embroiled in a discussion or a debate or a all-out war with the Orioles when it comes to revenues surrounding their TV market and their TV networks. But maybe they just think this is a good time to sell because after a World Series, you get that bump. And they think that's as far as they can take it. They've also sold and developed a ton of real estate around that ballpark. So maybe they're ready just to cash in. But I do think that we'll see some teams change hands. And I'm not sure it'll be good for the good. Because you will see probably more teams owned by conglomerates, larger groups of investors that have more of an emphasis on making it more profitable season to season. But I think that no matter what you're talking about, like spend more, whatever, make more, whatever, I think part of the Reds' problem has been the involvement of ownership in sort of day-to-day running of the enterprise, which is something that happens in a lot of the places where you're like, why hasn't that team won yet? Why hasn't that market produced a winner yet? A lot of times it is because the owner is too involved in the day-to-day practice of running a team. And so I don't want to say that because the Rays can do it, everybody else can, but I think the Rays show you a model of a team that doesn't spend a lot on payroll, but the people in the front office have a lot of autonomy. And they are allowed to run it the way they see it. And they are allowed to, you know, be efficient. And they also stick with one plan and do it for more than 1 year. The Reds seem like they have a new plan every 3 years. They're going to do this. They're going to spend on free agency. No, they're going to spend on coaching. They're going to spend on a pitching coordinator. They're going to do this. They change it every 3 years. And so every couple of years in Cincinnati, it's like, well, we've got a new plan. All right. Yeah.
I was actually wondering if the Winker Suarez trade, if that was time before people completed reading the new CBA and then they realized, oh no, we actually have to get money back on the books. And they made the trade to get Mike Minor for Amir Garrett. You know, that trade with the Royals, they signed Tommy Pham. They're not running a Cleveland payroll. Their payroll is over $100 million. That's okay, like that's fine. They should be able to
find a winner is what I'm saying. Like you could, like there are $100 million payroll winners. Yes,
I saw them as a legitimate threat to win the NL Central before the lockout ended, and they made the combination of moves that they made, and they're still not a bad team.
Got a lot of young pitching coming up. Lodolo and Green are very exciting.
Yeah, lots of reasons to be excited if you like young pitching in Cincinnati right now, but Not the best opening day performance by a front office member that we have seen.
The whole combination of like the trading Winker and, you know, right into this has just been kind of stepping up. You know, like what's that thing in The Simpsons where the dude just steps on the rake one after the other?
Oh, trying to remember.
Sideshow Bob?
Yes.
Sideshow Bob steps on like five rakes in a row or whatever.
Ooh, I wonder if Sideshow Bob is going to catch on Twitter now for Bob Castellini. We shall see.
Are you struggling to close deals? B2B selling is tougher than ever, and that's why I want to tell you about LinkedIn Sales Navigator. One more great product from LinkedIn. You're there to network, you're there to look for jobs, you're there to post jobs. And how about LinkedIn Sales Navigator? It's a sales intelligence platform that helps professionals effectively prospect and engage high-value customers, drive higher revenue, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator helps you target the right buyers, surface key signals such as job job changes or which accounts you should prioritize, and shows you hidden allies so you can find those buyers that are most likely to convert. Fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, Sales Navigator gives you the most up-to-date, first-party data, enabling you to unlock conversations with the people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/baseballshow. That is linkedin.com/baseballshow for a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/baseballshow and get started.
Some other week one observations. I think we should give out hardware on a weekly basis. I was thinking about awards, and I thought, what's the best award we could give someone who's never heard of our podcast, who doesn't care about little awards from a podcast they've never heard of? I thought if we had a hitter of the week and a pitcher of the week on this show, we could make the prize a pack of baseball cards from the year that the player debuted or the year that the player was born, whichever is cheaper for us to provide to that player as an award. And it would also come with a handwritten thank you note or a congratulatory note from you and me and Britt. And we could offer that up every week this season. It requires an extraordinary amount of effort. So perhaps we'll gather up all the information and see if we can actually make awards. We can hand out fake awards. Pitcher of the week for the first week of the season. I'm throwing Tyler McGill out there, you know. Vila was up. Two very good starts, filling the shoes of Jacob DeGrom and looking more DeGromish than we would have expected. No one's Jacob DeGrom, but Tyler McGill throwing a lot harder. That in and of itself is pretty interesting for the Mets, who might need him a lot more than they expected just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that Jake DeGrom has gone down with injury, and now Taijuan Walker. And they also have some, you know, there's Carlos Carrasco on that staff, so they're going to need Tyler McGill. And you know, the nice thing that really stood out is, you know, last year he had two good secondaries in the slider and the changeup, and that's rare enough to have, you know, a changeup and a breaking ball that are plus. You know, in my experience, it's been mostly players are one or the other, you know, multiple breaking balls or a changeup and like a cutter or something, you know, something to get them where they need to go. But, you know, he had two good secondaries and the fastball wasn't great. But if you pump up even a fastball with not the greatest shape, if you pump it up to 96, 97, you're going to, and he's one of the biggest risers in my metric called Stuff Plus, which looks at the shape and velocity of pitches. So he's now threatening to be kind of like a top 40 type pitcher after just two starts of really excellent work. So I think everything under the hood says that he was as good as the results on the field.
Yeah, that four-seamer up almost two ticks from where it was last year. So pretty significant velo increase for Tyler McGill. Any other candidates for you for pitcher of the week in week one? I mean, getting two starts in a week kind of puts you at the front of the line, barring That's some right. kind of complete game shutout or something amazing that a pitcher can do.
Well, Matt Brash was really exciting. Mm-hmm. His debut, he didn't win it. So, you know, somebody can say he lost. But he showed the best Stuff Plus of anybody of any starter in baseball so far. And that's because he's got really good ride on a really hard fastball. Then he's got a kind of a sweepy sideways breaking ball. And then he also has a more vertical up-down breaking ball. I don't know what you want to call either of them. I would say maybe slider and curve, but you know, they also go really fast. I mean, he's talking about a mid 80s breaking ball, like sort of high 80s and a low 80s breaking ball. So this guy has the two breaking ball approach. It looks really excellent. They went on the radio broadcast for the Mariners. They said that internally, you know, the Mariners Stuff Plus for his slider said it was 90% better than the average slider. They had
90%
190s
better.
On his slider. You know, so another coach I talked to that worked with him said that it was the best slider he had ever seen. So I think that's those are some good superlatives to throw on a guy that had held the White Sox lineup. Even if he lost, he held that White Sox lineup down. And that is an impressive feat for a debut. And he also just looked really unfazed doing it. Like he was just He's just gripping it and ripping it like he was ready to go. So that's my candidate. I can see giving it to McGill, though.
All right. Well, I think we're going to give it to McGill, but I was excited about Matt Brash. Not at all surprised that your pitching model liked him, because it was kind of like when I watched Shane McClanahan's debut last year, where it was kind of like, whoa, hey, wait a minute. Why was this guy not the number one pitching prospect in baseball based on the eye test? And obviously getting to see everybody at various stages makes it a little easier to draw those conclusions. But people may have been sleeping a bit on Matt Brash, in part because of his delivery. It's something that Keith Law talked about, I believe, on last Friday's episode of the Athletic Baseball Show. So we'll see physically how he holds up with that delivery as this season
plays out. There were some that thought that he would be a reliever. He also, you know, just the way that he was drafted and what happened, I actually see there's some parallels to the Fernando Tatis trade, where when the Padres got Fernando Tatis, he'd just been in like short season ball, and so nobody had really seen him. He was so young that there hadn't been that many people who'd seen him. He hadn't played that much. And so the people that did see him had really conviction in what they'd seen, and they targeted him. They wanted to get him. And then with the Brash thing, what happened was he got drafted out of college, pitched a little, but he'd pitched a lot that year. And so they shut him down. And then in 2020, he wasn't at the alternate site. So here's another pitcher that when at the time that the Padres traded him to the Mariners for Taylor Williams, had not really pitched a lot. A lot of people hadn't seen him. But the beauty of these stuff metrics is that they are useful really quickly. You only need 300 pitches, even 200 pitches, there's signal in it. So if you get 300 pitches of data on this guy, you can start to say something real about this player, even if he hasn't pitched for a whole season. And I think the Mariners probably said, listen, this is the best slider that in the Padres organization. And they put him on the list of players to be named later. Let us take that and figure out if he's going to be a reliever or a starter. And they've done a great job developing. I mean, I think it's a kudos to them that they've gotten him to the potential of 140 innings this year. I don't think that necessarily that delivery screams injury to me.
On TV, from behind, didn't look as bad as it might from behind home plate, because when I was watching him, like, mechanics are not my expertise, but I didn't see anything that scared me. But you see, sometimes you see guys pitch like, oh, that's unusual. It didn't look that weird to me from the TV angles, at least. So
there's some side angles where there's some argument about how flexed your knee needs to be when you land. You know, I've heard it just yesterday in the clubhouse. I was talking to a pitcher about it. And, you know, yes, I do think that it's probably better to have some flexion in the knee. And he looked a little bit sort of like against a locked knee. So there is a little bit of whip at the end. I would say that we're not at the point where there are yeses and nos and this is the way you should pitch in baseball. Like, we're working on biomechanical research, and there's a lot of good stuff coming out of it, but, you know, there's no like writ large, this is how thou shalt pitch, and everyone who does not pitch this way shall get hurt.
I have a weird thought and opinion about this. I kind of feel like you should just do what doesn't hurt. If it doesn't hurt your shoulder and your elbow, it's working for you. I realize that in and of itself isn't enough. You need to have mechanics that are consistent and clean. But at a certain point, if you get people to do things that feel unnatural, I think you're more likely to put extra stress on the shoulder and the elbow. So yeah, the perfect mechanics thing, that's been elusive as long as I've been following baseball. And it doesn't seem like we're really like locked in on anything at this point.
I think that's a really smart thing to say, because, you know, when you get a pitcher, especially in the major leagues, or even, you know, even a guy who you just brought into your organization, they've been pitching. They've thrown thousands of pitches before they met you, you know? And so, you know, there's this temptation, even with a 17-year-old who they've thrown thousands of pitches, even at 17, you know? And there's this temptation to be like, oh, dude, you can't throw like that. And then you say, okay, we got to throw like this. And then you change them into a position that their body is not comfortable with. And it just doesn't work. you know? And this can have effects when you're talking about, oh, we're really trying to get more ride out of this guy's fastball. So can you do this with your arm in order to get more ride out of it? And then they're just like, I'm not throwing with conviction. This doesn't feel good. And B, like, you know, I can't command it anymore because it's this new movement that I'm not, you know, that I haven't thrown for thousands of pitches. So there is a lot of art. It's not just science when it comes to pitching coaching, where you're like, hey, this is the best way to do things. Your pitches should look like this and blah, 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 blah. You have to listen, you know, to the player, and the player can tell you, I can't throw that. It doesn't feel good when I throw that. I can't command it when I throw that. And so you have to alter how you're coaching them to kind of take that input from the pitcher and do what feels good.
Let's get to a hitter of the week selection. I think this one sort of wrote itself on the rundown. It seems like the Stephen Kwan experience has been maybe the biggest performance-related
he
highlight.
He just, while we were recording this, got his first swinging strike and his first strikeout.
Oh, whoa.
Nick Lodolo.
Nick Lodolo
put Stephen Kwan in his book. it was Nick Lodolo's first strikeout. Oh, that was a fun thing that C. Trance Rosecrans pointed out. They both got their first strikeout at the same time. Except that it was a little bit more meaningful when it comes to Kwan, because he went like 110 pitches without missing a single. He saw 110 pitches and didn't miss a single one. So, I mean, elite bat to ball with really good plate discipline, which doesn't always happen. A lot of these guys who have elite plate bat to ball swing a lot.
They can hit everything. They have the gift of hitting everything, so they swing a ton. Like
Luis Arias, Jeff McNeil, Nico Horner, Nick Madrigal. None of those guys has like a 10% walk rate. Yeah. You know, they all kind of just like slap. Here we go. I can hit that. I'm gonna hit it. Where Kwan kind of puts together a combination of a really good eye at the plate, and he says that the team has actually been telling him to kind of identify some counts and situations where he can let it rip further. And so maybe access some of that power to add to it. Because that's the only sort of complaint that anybody could have about Stephen Kwan is how many homers is he going to hit? Is he going to hit 7? Is he going to hit 12? Maybe it doesn't matter if he has a 400 on-base percentage and hits 350. So it is fun, really, in a league where we have so many guys who can hit tons of homers and strike out 25% of the time. It is fun to watch Stephen Kwan. You just know he's going to put the ball in play, and that is fun to watch. So, you know, more power to that group I just named. May all of them have jobs all season, and may all of them continue to put the ball in play.
Nice combination of guys that don't strike out a lot at the top of the order in Cleveland, right? You have Miles Straw, who also got an extension, Kwan, and then Jose Ramirez, all under 20% K rates. And then if you bring in someone like Franmil Reyes as your cleanup hitter, well, there's a pretty good chance someone's on base for Franmil Reyes, so all good things.
He's your more traditional type hitter where he'll strike out a bit, but when you put him behind all these guys getting on base, that's a really good combo. So
yeah,
maybe there's something brewing there. I mean, they've always had really excellent pitching development, and you know, by Zips, which we mentioned earlier, Zips projections, they have the most top 100 prospects as projected by Zips. So they are a data and tech team that also, I think, has had the conviction to kind of zig a little bit when other people were zagging. I mean, they got Miles Straw from the Astros, who are, you know, at the forefront of when it comes to player development and R&D and sort of being a progressive future-looking baseball team. They got Miles Straw from them for not too much. And, you know, he fit right into the top of their lineup, and they're happy with that trade. So that this is a team that's sort of zigging and being like, hey, we will lose some power at the expense of making contact.
Others receiving votes for our week one awards. How about Seiya Suzuki? 4 games into his big league career, 3 home runs, showing a very patient eye already. I think if you were among the teams that were close back when he signed that 5-year, $85 million deal with the Cubs, this first week has made you even more sad that you missed out based on what we're seeing so far.
Yeah, tough week for the Padres with losing Matt Brash and Seiya Suzuki, which would have helped helped him a lot. There is a stat called reach rate or chase rate, which is how often a player swings at a non-strike, at a ball. Seiya Suzuki, number one in baseball, just really disciplined. Just to give you a sense of some of the other players on this list, Christian Yelich is second. Juan Soto, of course, is third. But other good players like Mitch Garver, Jesse Winker, Josh Lau, and Gavin Lux to get some young guys on there. Matt Olson, Mookie Betts. It's a good place to live.
Yeah, the other hitters that tore it up in week one include Byron Buxton, who's laying the groundwork for a little MVP run. Wander Franco has been red hot. And Jose Ramirez, even with the extension, also starting the season.
Buxton gets the honorable mention, though, I think. One real standout moment for him was taking 102 from Andres Munoz. That was about 3-4 inches above the top of the zone and taking him yard. That was a doozy. I mean, that's almost more of a like a visual. If you were just going to give the award based on one visual, it would be that one, I think. But Kwan has that sort of the hype and the body of work, I think.
I saw Cedric Mullins go lefty-lefty at the top of the zone on a Josh Hader fastball and miss a home run by inches. It was a double, and it was only the seventh double that Josh Hader has allowed to a lefty in his entire career. That was one of those stats when they said it during the game. Like, wait a minute, could that possibly be right? And yeah, that's just the kind of dominance that Hader has had against lefties. I mean, Mullins missed a game-tying home run by millimeters. A very impressive display of hitting. He had a grand slam earlier in that game. And then Hunter Green, I think also on the pitching side, just from a fun debuts standpoint, I really wanted to bring this up because this is the concern. If you're watching on YouTube in the Rates and Barrels YouTube channel, Hunter Green averaged over 99 miles per hour on his four-seamer in his debut. You don't see a lot of guys doing that as starters. The problem, as you can see on the screen, and I'll describe it for you if you're not watching on screen, is the location, right? Mm-hmm. We talk about the heat maps. You can get these from Baseball Savant. You have what looks like, this isn't even a fried egg necessarily. This is just a red dot right in the middle of the strike zone. And you can get away with that for a little while, but big league hitters eventually start to square that up. And I think that's going to be the key to Hunter Green's rookie season is whether or not he locates his fastball consistently more up in the zone. If he can get that ball up in the zone, top third of the zone more consistently, it's going to be a really good pitch for him. But if he's missing with his fastball over the heart of the plate, it is going to get punished by big league hitters.
It's part of an ongoing debate about stuff versus command, but I would point out that he had the second best stuff number among starters to Matt Brash. And that you can actually look at, you know, the results on like 99, like he throws down the middle, and they are better than, you know, dotting 90 in some places. So
sure.
You know, I think the bet with him is I'm here to outstuff you. That's what I'm here to do. I'm just here to throw it by you. I don't care. You know, I'm gonna aim towards the middle of the zone because I don't want to walk you. So I think I can beat you wherever. So I it's fascinating. I love watching him pitch, and the slider has taken a real step forward, I think, too, in the development process. So he's a legitimate pitcher.
Yeah, the slider location was excellent. Threw it mostly to righties, and it was consistently down and away, but still in the zone a lot too. So, you know, a called strike, but also a pitch you really can't do much with if he's locating it that well. So I would say slider command, very good. Fastball command, while he can get away with it, I still think I'd like to see that red dot just a little higher, because catching up to that 99 plus up at the letters,
or maybe that's two not dots happen. Like one a little bit lower and one a little higher rather than just one dot right in the middle.
Exactly. But a great first week so far, and a lot of great young players in the game right now getting those opportunities. We didn't even talk about guys like Julio Rodriguez and Spencer Torkelson. It's been a bit of a slow start for a lot of them. Bobby Witt Jr. had a nice showing on opening day. You know, we're going to get to those guys as things happen. It's a hard game, as everyone is learning.
Congratulations to those guys on their first hits, though.
Yeah. Well, it's been a great week of baseball overall. That is going to do it for this episode of the 3-0 Show. Give us a follow on Twitter. You can find Eno at EnoSaris. You can find Britt at Britt_Diroli. You can find me at Derek Van Riper. Drop us an email, ratesandbarrels@theathletic.com. Just make it known that it's for the 3-0 Show. We can take those questions on a future week. And if you got ideas for these little prizes that we might give players for winning our silly little awards, hit us up. I think the baseball card thing might actually take off at some point, especially if we keep getting players that were born in the 90s. Those are easily available packs of baseball
cards. They made a lot of those cards.
Yes. They have a lot of players we choose for player of the week were born in 91, 92, and 93. You'll know the reason. It was because the budget for the awards is low.
Yeah.
It's because we had 50 cents per week to spend on our awards. Get a subscription to The Athletic for just $1 a month at theathletic.com/baseball show. The Athletic Baseball Show returns on Friday.
At the 3-0 Show, you've always got the green light.